I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are Rene Redzepi, world-renowned chef and co-owner of NOMA in Copenhagen, and David Zilber, director of the NOMA Fermentation Lab. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Rene Redzepi and David Zilber. I'm so excited to be hosting Rene Redzepi and David Zilber tonight. Their work and their book, The NOMA Guide to Fermentation, had such an impact on me and my whole team that we were inspired to frame our entire fall season around the idea of fermenting change. Our programmers and educators were struck by the fact that fermentation is by its nature transformative. You take an agricultural product and through microbial action, it's turned into something wholly different. An iteration of what it once was. And the timing for this event also coincides with the Jewish New Year, the start of the New Year, which began over a month ago, a time for reflecting on how we might make real change in our own lives. Just like the philosophies of tonight's guests, Jewish tradition appreciates the extraordinary in the ordinary, and that the applied wisdom of the physical world can teach us something very deep about our own lives. So, deeply moved by all of this, we have focused on hosting changemakers in many different worlds this season. Yes, of course, the culinary, but also changemakers in other spheres, artistic, political, social, including Pussy Riot founder Nadia Tolokonikova, Transparence creator Jill Soloway, and many more. And with that, we are thrilled to welcome Rene Redzepi and David Zilber to San Francisco tonight. Rene is, of course, chef owner of NOMA in Copenhagen, which has four times been recognized as the world's best restaurant. And David is the director of NOMA's Fermentation Lab. They are here this evening to show us why fermentation is both the driving force and the soul of NOMA.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Rene Redzepi. Thank you for being here. Fermentation to us at the restaurant has become the bloodline for us. But I want to tell you just a little bit about how this all started, how fermentation entered the life of NOMA. In order to understand that, we probably need to go back into the beginning of NOMA. So NOMA is 15 years old this year. It opened in November 23 of 2003. I was 25 years old, and it was a terrible cold winter that year. And you know, we were planning this for more than a year, and we thought, let's open up and let's focus on local ingredients. And you know, saying that 15 years later almost doesn't make sense to talk about how different that was back then in Copenhagen. 15 years ago, who can remember how life was, how the world was 15 years ago? 15 years ago, you could smoke in every restaurant. 15 years ago, there was no Instagram. Life was so much better back then, of course. But back then in the Scandinavias, you know, it was just a wild thing to say. Let's focus on local food stuff. And so it was a cold winter, and then we tried to do menus, and it was like, wow, we may have made a mistake here, you know. Is our life going to consist of onions and beets and kale for the rest of our lives? But what happened then was that in sheer desperation, you start actually investigating things that nobody had ever told you to investigate before in culinary school. We started reading books that nobody had ever showed you before. And into our life came things like the idea of foraging, the wilderness. What is a season? What does seasonality mean? We learned about this idea of preservation. We understood that we are from a cold climate region, and our ancestors, they really had to preserve in order to survive the cold winters. But what we did first, of course, was that we stepped into the wild. Following spring, it was about March in 2004, early spring for us. The snow frost defrosted, and we found ourselves, you know, in our wellies on the shoreline in a forest, trying to look for all these things that we've been reading about. And at one point, there's a pivotal moment that I always mention because it's truly laid the foundation to our restaurant. And it was on a beach. And I mean, you guys are from California, and well, how can I say this? I mean, our beaches are not California beaches. You have to imagine a beach full of rocks. There's lots of rotting seaweed all over, nasty biting flies, and of course, lots of greenery, lots of fresh seaweed. So we're walking into this space, and our feet are sort of stomping into this knee-deep in the rotting seaweed, and then we find this patch of green. Intuitively, you're drawn to it. We go there. We snap this greenery. And it, you know, it cracks like when you cut into a watermelon, and we bite into it. It looks like a chive, a little thicker than a chive. And then the flavor hits us, and it was the flavor of coriander. And again, going back 15 years ago, coriander. To you guys here, you are such a diverse community, and you know, you have Mexico nearby. Coriander, probably for all of you, or cilantro, as you call it here, that's probably commonplace. But 15 years ago, that was one of the most exotic things in Denmark. It really was. It's hard to imagine, but it truly, truly was. You just never got it. And most people, if they had it, they thought it was like soapy. No, don't give me that. It's this exotic thing. And suddenly we were in the cold north. And, you know, a few months before that, it was all beets and onions. And suddenly we were tasting coriander from a beach plant. And it was a pivotal moment in which it was like, you know, wow, what else is there? That was sort of the thinking. And then we really went full on, and we wanted everything. And we were so enthusiastic because nobody had ever told us about this as a cook in culinary school. You learn techniques of certain things and some history, but not that type of history, not that type of culinary cooking. And so we discovered, you know, you can actually eat trees beyond the sap. If you harvest the pine cones in their first early season, they can be so delicious. They can have the same texture as a toffee, as a caramel toffee. You can simmer some of them in sugar, and they become these perfect candies. You can salt some of them, and they turn into olives, but they taste like forest. It was like a complete revelation for us, this wilderness. With that, of course, quickly, we started also wanting to have this wilderness into the next season, and into the next season, and we were specifically looking for having it in winter so we could spice up the beets with something. Wouldn't it be nice to have slices of salted pine cone with our beets? And then we started dabbling into what we at first called preservation or pickling. I think we call it the pickling cuisine at first. I like to have labels for things, and so that label, I think we call it first, was pickling. And then, of course, as we dabble into it, we start reading and reading more and more, and you start investigating. You're figuring out, wow, there's a whole world of fermentation out there. There's people doing it in very sophisticated ways and have been doing it so for centuries. We started to learn from everyone. We started to travel. And it grew and grew and grew and grew on us. Until a very certain moment where we were playing around with sauerkraut. I don't know if any of you have fermented anything, but sauerkraut is kind of like the first level of fermentation. I mean, it's in every single fermentation book that's already out there. It's the one thing that most people know, oh, that's fermented, hardy cabbage. And so as we were dabbling into this, we started reading about the science of fermentation, actually, which proved to be incredibly useful for us, because then we could figure out what is actually that goes on, and then you stopped seeing ingredients, you just saw the components of it. And then you realize, well, I can take this salt and I can put other things into it. And the lactic acid fermentation will happen. And so we did that with gooseberries. And one day, one of the cooks, it's our longest standing cook in the kitchen. He's been with us for 11 years. He comes to me and he presents me this murky this spoon with this murky liquid in. And he says, "Taste this, chef." And, you know, it's like most things fermented. It's not really Instagram friendly. I'm going to pre-warn you about that. It won't make your followers sore. I mean, you have beautiful ingredients and then you do things to it and then it turns brown, more or less. but he gave me this murky liquid and you know, it was made from gooseberries. So Gooseberry is like, it's like a grandma fruit. It's the thing that you have all through your childhood and all through your life. You eat it and you know it very well. You know it intimately until you have lactic acid fermented gooseberry juice. And you taste that and suddenly it's like, what is going on? It was one of these pivotal moments again where, wow, we can take this thing that we know so well and it becomes something more. And then once you realize it, you can take that liquid and you can actually cook it into a syrup. And you can do all sorts of things with it afterwards. It was like one ingredient now could become 100 ingredients. Like the grain of rice had become 1,000 different things. A lot of these things, after their fermentation, they become other things too. It truly is amazing for us. That was a crucial moment for our fermentation mode. We simply went into beast mode after this. At first, we didn't really know what we were doing. I mean, we were fermenting up in the attic in one of the old buildings that was like 300 years old. And we wanted to do it the romantic way, you know, like we'd read about how they do it in Japan and in Korea. And we would take these jars and we'd put them on top when it was cold. And then when it was next day, it would be warm. And then we had to, you know, and it would be like hundreds of kilos of food stuff moving them around. It would be incredibly time consuming. Then if I fast forward a little more, the next pivotal moment for our fermentation's love is about 6 years ago when we decided to close the old Noma. For those of you who don't know this, we just moved to a new location. But this the decision for this move was made almost 6 years ago. And it was made, again, by feeling the gut. And I had been waking up for a little while and going to work and feeling that this routine that was working really well for us was also starting to limit us. And that is one of the true problems of success, that it, at least in our case, it was limiting us. We were starting to think too much in the same way. And so one of the ways I thought we'd be able to do something is like, go to work in a new way. Like, could we actually go to work and feel like we have a new job if we move to a different place? And so I told my team, and a couple of weeks later, we were going to have a staff party, and Peter Kreiner, the general manager at the time, he calls me up and he says, the party won't be at this place I'm looking at, but it could be the old, it could be the new Noma. And so I drove there immediately on my bike. When we say drive in Denmark, it's actually biking. And it's no more than like 3 kilometers away. But still, it's like a transformation of space because it's on the backside of what is called Christiania. Christiania is a little community. It used to be military grounds that got taken over by hippies in the 70s. And it's truly its own little unique space of Copenhagen. It's like, you know, Denmark is a very homogenous place of 5 million people. You know, when there's a popular TV show, 2.5 million people will watch it. And then it's like, we're a line, and then you have Christiania, you know? We need that to show that we have something else in us, too. So we are on the back of that. And they have made their beautiful little community for good and worse. It's also a place to have high-quality weed, actually, in... Not that I know anything about that, but I'm just letting you know in case you come to the restaurant and you know, we're a tasting menu restaurant, so you can... if you start at Christiania, you will get going. I fell in love with that space immediately. We are on the water. It's an old military grounds. It's just pristine. You know, we're right in the center of town, but we have a hectare of land, and it's also surrounded by a national heritage. It's actually just a mound. It's just dirt. But that mound was built 400 years ago as a fortification of medieval Copenhagen, and you know, nothing can ever be built there. This is our space. And so we decided to plan for it. We decided that this is it. And so a few questions came when you decide that, of course. The first thing I got worried about once we had decided it, I only thought of it after we decided it and we had sort of ripped our lease for the old place, was, what if we just move the routines, you know, to the new place? What if we're just going to go there and we're going to just do the same? So at that moment, that was a moment when we decided to do our pop-ups. We've been in Japan, we've been in Australia, we've been in Mexico. But first, we thought of Japan as a place to go and train. How can we go to a place, can we go to a place that is so different, where the ingredients are different? They speak a different language, the culture couldn't be more different. Can we actually see fresh opportunity? Or will we go there and just look for a replacement for beet in that same dish? Or will we be able to do something new? And it was a very tough journey to going there and learning this. But we were able to go there, and I feel, we all of us felt, do something that was Noma, but it felt like we were doing something new again, like we were searching again. And it felt good. So that was like, okay, we can do this. I think we can go back, and a new space will give us fresh perspective again. And so we did a couple of more. Then another big question came after that. How are we going to do the whole setup for the menus and so on? You know, I was never wanted to be a one tasting menu restaurant. We were never that. We were forced into this. I really truly mean that. We were forced into becoming a tasting menu restaurant. Success made us that. I never actually wanted to have a restaurant that's always booked out where you can't come from the streets. But we've tested this where people can wait, you know, and there's a couple of seats. But that means people just come at 2 o'clock in the morning. Really? And the line is like, and people are so disappointed. So I thought to myself, I'm also tired of this tasting menu format. I mean, we're still a tasting menu restaurant, but but you know, this idea of here's the meat and here's some fish and a little bit of vegetables in between, it was the same. It didn't matter where you were in the world. It was always the same setup. There might be a few different ingredients, but the setup would be the same. And you know, honestly, you had to maybe visit Noma once every second year for it to really feel like it was a fresh menu somehow. And most tasting menus restaurants are probably the same. And then we started thinking deep about what we were doing. And then, of course, it dawned on us that why don't we just focus on the ingredients that are truly in season? In the growing season, when we have things in abundance, why do we need fish and meat? Why can't we be vegetarian in that period? Do we dare to do that? Yes, we do. And then when the leaves fall from the trees, we go into the forest. That's what the tradition dictates us. And we hunt the animals, and we become a restaurant of the wilderness. Then from January on to May, when nothing is growing, we had a problem there at first. We couldn't actually crack the code until we thought, well, it's actually in the ocean. That's the high season in that moment. And so suddenly it was so clear to us that this was what we wanted to do. And within these three ingredient flows, there's, of course, a myriad of micro-seasons. But as we decided on doing that, the big worry came, which was, what is a vegetarian meal? You can study temple cuisines in Korea, in China, in Japan, and there will be a structure. It's not incredibly diverse, because there's always rice and a tofu and so on. But what is a vegetarian meal in the West? What's a vegetarian main course? When you ask that question, you know, when we were doing the seafood menu, it was like, how can we be original with cod? That's the difficult thing. Here it was like, what is actually a vegetarian meal? How do you plan a full menu? And, you know, some people say, oh, it's a risotto for main course, because that's what typically you get if you're a vegetarian, or some pasta or something, right? And I got very worried that we wouldn't be able to do this vegetarian menu, that we'd disappoint people, that they'd be eating leaves and salads. And so at that moment, it was we thought to us, or told ourselves, that the key to this is in the fermentation lab. That's where we will find enough potency and robustness in flavor that we can make a bowl of spinach as delicious as a piece of cooked steak or lobster.
You're listening to Renee Redzepi, world-renowned chef and co-owner of Noma in Copenhagen, and David Zilber, director of the Noma Fermentation Lab, whose new book is The Noma Guide to Fermentation, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so we decided to build a lab. And at first, it was all shipping containers, bought cheap. And we went to IKEA and bought the second cheapest kitchen in IKEA. And we just built it together, and we read some more books, and suddenly we had this lab. But it was a big moment where we said, we have our kitchen, we're going to take the idea of fermentation out of the kitchen and make it its own complete section with its own team. And they do nothing but just that. We need to accelerate here. And of course, in doing so, if you have the right people doing it, it will make things explode. And since then, it's only gone up for us. And that leaves me with the idea of this book here. Because as we're developing all this, as this was becoming really truly the DNA of who we are as a restaurant, it is for us today completely impossible to have a flavor at Noma in any season and not have anything fermented in it. It's much more easy not having anything foraged in it. Fermentation had eclipsed foraging a long time ago for us as the main pillar. And I actually believe in this quite a lot, that this is a way to make cooking easier. It is for us. It has fueled our creativity again. I always say that before fermentation, we had like a handful of Legos. When fermentation came into our world, we had a basketful. And all these Legos, it's up to us to now learn how to play with them and figure out how to build with them. But truly, it is something that has transformed our restaurant. And we have more than 100 different things that we have developed over the years. And this is also important to say that this book is a Noma book. There won't be for instance, there's not a sauerkraut recipe in this book. because we wanted for it to be true to what our restaurant is. And we also, for the first time, wanted to do a book that people could actually use at home to open up and cook from. As we were planning this book, it dawned on me that I'd never, ever, ever heard anyone say, hey, I cooked that dish from one of your last books. One has a finger up here. Okay, which one? The ice cream. Wow, man, you're crazy. So that has now become this book, and as you will see, as you can see in the book, there's a different name than myself on the cover, and it's Mr. David Zilber. He's from Canada. There's a Canadian over here. and he's going to come up here on the stage, and he's going to introduce some more about what it is that we do, because he is a specialist, and I am not a specialist in the way that he is a specialist. He is truly, truly, truly a specialist in this field, and I am just a little insect in comparison to what he knows. It is also the first time that David Zilber is stepping onto the stage, so to speak, on this journey here. He is in our kitchen normally, a big part of our kitchen, but now he's stepping onto the stage. This is the third event that we do on our tour here, but it is still only the first time that he's really trying it, so please be very kind to him when he comes on, when he comes on stage here now. And also take pictures of him, because I think you're going to be hearing a lot from David Zilber in the future. He's going to be one of the greatest. I don't believe that. So please welcome Mr. David Zilber.
Hello, everyone. So, why do we ferment? Well, we ferment because the juicy fat of a frankfurter is that much better when it's cut with crunchy sauerkraut. We ferment because a cold, effervescent kombucha is incredibly refreshing on a hot summer day. We ferment because miso soup warms our souls in the winter. We ferment because gooey cheese, bright vinaigrettes, luxurious champagne, and crunchy sourdough bread are all delicious. Now, all of these things and hundreds more are why people ferment today. But if we really want to get to the crux of the matter, we have to go back in time and ask why people started fermenting in the first place. Now, since prehistory, human beings have strived to make food last. In our ancient days as hunter-gatherers, 1,000 calories of energy spent looking for food in the field would yield about 1,000 calories of food upon our return to camp. It was actually quite hard work to stay alive. So it's no wonder then that about 10,000 years ago, all over the world, independently of each other, cultures began to make the switch to agriculture. The domestication of different crops like rice, maize, soybeans, barley, wheat, sorghum, fueled humanity like foraging never could. These were calorie, protein, nutrient-rich plants that we tamed, intended to. But the most important part of the agricultural revolution was the fact that the crops that we were growing were cellarable. These were seeds and pulses and grains that we could dry and store for use at a later date when nutrition was more scarce. In effect, we'd finally found a way to make food last. We could make caloric surpluses. But not all foods could be treated this way. What about leafy greens or fruits and vegetables or the meats and milks of the animals we hunted or herded? How could we keep those foods from going off? If agriculture revolutionized human survival, then fermentation stepped up to be the next step in that revolution. We discovered that a bit of unseen help and some salt went a long way to keeping those foods around longer. Bit by bit, accident by accident, our ancestors discovered that they could actually kind of steer these processes. They could have some modicum of control over them and make the things they wanted to make. Turn grape juice into wine, take fish from the ocean, turn that into fish sauce, turn cabbages into kimchi. Fermentation provided humans with the means to hold on to foods that would undeniably spoil if untreated. Now, our scientific understanding of fermentation has increased exponentially in recent history. The entire field of microbiology has only been around for a bit more than 100 years. Meanwhile, fermentation has been serving mankind for millennia. And millennia ago, we can never really know what was going on in the minds of our ancestors, but we know that when they tasted a vat of boiling or bubbling juice or moldy beans, they enjoyed it. And we know that because we still do it today. You see, ferments are living artifacts. These are processes that echo through time. They're handed down from generation to generation through hands both human and microbial. Unbeknownst to our ancestors, they were co-evolving with the unseen agents of fermentation, microbes. And to this day, we still are. So, it begs the question, what actually is happening in that crock of plant matter as it's transformed on your kitchen counter over the course of weeks? You peer in and see it change. Well, it varies from process to process, but the gist of it is this. Microbes, microorganisms, work to break down organic matter. In doing so, they garner useful chemical energy to fuel their own life cycles and multiply, and then leave something else behind in the process. The something else that gets left behind is often an exclusionary chemical. Think about it, lactic acid by bacteria, citric acid by certain fungi, or alcohol by yeast. These are chemicals that have been designed blindly by evolution to eke out the competition and make these environments safe for the microbes to produce them, or by the microbes that produce them and them alone, or so they think. Because humans, well, we're uniquely poised to find some of these chemicals not just tolerable, but actually delicious and useful. The byproducts of fermentation were, in fact, humankind's first added preservatives. All natural, though. But beyond fermentation's usefulness as a means of preservation, it's also extremely good at making food more digestible. As microbes break down large molecules and turn them into small ones, taking starches and chopping them up into simple sugars, or taking proteins and breaking them down into amino acids, they're giving fermenters, humans, the basic units of organic matter that our bodies crave to do everything they need to, from fuel itself to build itself. And our bodies are trained to find these flavors extremely delicious. Now, the pressure to preserve food has definitely eased up in recent history. Almost every household in the United States has a refrigerator in it to keep food fresh. So we're posed with another question. Why go through the trouble to ferment? Why go through all the hassle? A chef can live in an aseasonal world. Why keep something around for 6 months? Well, as I mentioned, fermentation is uniquely delicious. Without it, Noma's food wouldn't be Noma's food. Every year at the restaurant, we spend an enormous amount of energy trying to can and preserve the natural world while it's at its peak in an effort to make those flavors last. Like Chef said, we've been doing it for 15 years, and some of our accidents led to different flavors, flavors that both intrigued and enticed us. Like our forebears, we got hooked. Now, we weren't just preserving to preserve, we began fermenting to ferment to create new sensations, and then the goalposts seemed to have shifted. We began fermenting to bring acidity, brightness, depth of flavor, umami, complexity, and nuance to our dishes. We began fermenting to bring delight to our guests and to ourselves. Now, the same globalized and aseasonal world that can bring a chef white asparagus in the dead of winter for use on his menu has also left us a bit disconnected from the practices and traditions that got us here in the first place. If we've done anything by writing this book and putting it out there for the world, it's in the hopes that we are going to inspire people like yourselves to see the real transformative power of fermentation and to think that you can do it successfully, and not just successfully, but creatively, as we have, and do this even at home. So, no book tour presentation is complete without a demo, so I'll be doing that for you today. Unfortunately, as Renee said, this is probably the least Instagrammable thing you could do in a kitchen. I compare showing someone how to ferment to watching paint dry. We'll be doing a little bit of jumping through time, because if we were to actually sit here and make these things, well, we'd go hungry. But I also want to show you, you know, just what goes into this, because, I mean, for me, when I first started at Noma, just as a chef de partie, you had no idea how these things were made. You'd be in the kitchen, you'd be using these products, they'd be made by a team in the bunker, and you'd taste them, you'd think, wow, these are so incredible, but what goes on? It was daunting, it was alien, it was foreign, you didn't understand the processes. I didn't know the difference between a fungus and a bacteria. You'd miscategorize them. And once you dispel all those notions, it really starts to click. You start connecting the dots, and you start seeing, okay, this isn't that strange. You start understanding something about the natural world. So to prove that point, I will ferment for you. Now, we've got some blueberries. We've got some salt. Now we have blueberries and salt. A little weight, a little more weight. That was a play on words, if you didn't get it. And congratulations, you're a fermenter. So I know this is San Francisco. I know you guys all have mason jars in your kitchens. So yes, you can go home and do this right away, but that's the beauty of it. It doesn't have to seem foreign. I know that Whole Foods has an aisle that's probably, you know, 100 meters long of this stuff, and you have no idea how it's made. You know it's good, you know it's useful, you know it's healthy for you, but you also think it's somehow out of your hands. But it's not. It's really this simple. That's all it takes. As a fermenter, you're just deciding what gets to grow. Like a farmer. It's that easy. We'll do something a little bit more complicated now. But again, to prove that it is that simple and worthwhile, we're going to be making soy sauce. Except it's not actually soy sauce, because there's no soy in it. At Noma, we look to faraway cultures and try and understand the processes, break them down, and then put on our own inputs. And that's what made Noma so special, especially when it got into fermentation, because we were creating new things with new flavors that hadn't really existed before. And this is a perfect example. Split yellow peas that have just been boiled till they're tender. Some toasted cracked wheat. Mix the two together. And find it a nice little bed. And now I will introduce you to one of the most important members on staff of Restaurant Noma, a fungus called Aspergillus oryzae. This is the fungus that is responsible for almost everything you've ever eaten in Japan, from soy sauce to miso to rice wine vinegar to mirin to sake to on and on and on. This is the thing that has all the transformative power that makes Japan's cuisine as good as it is. And Noma popped up in Japan first because, as chefs, we think it is one of the greatest cuisines on earth. This is probably why. So, these spores just get dusted onto... Don't worry. It's fine. I've been breathing this stuff in for years and I still don't have asthma. Tuck it in a nice little blanket, and via the magic of television, 2 days later, you get green, moldy peas and wheat. Fascinating. To do that, all you need is a styrofoam box, a humidifier, and one of these, a heating blanket. Now, you can put together an incubating chamber. We tell you how on page, 38 or something in the book. By going to the hardware store and spending probably well less than $100. It's really that easy. This is how we got started at Noma. And that's really all it takes. Again, not that daunting. It's just about understanding what it takes to do it. From here, all of this cake of koji, peas, and wheat, gets put into a jar with a bit of salt and water. This is already a brine, pour it over top, cover it, and wait even longer. We really don't have time for this one. But 4 to 6 months later, and the transformation is complete. Now, why should you be making your own soy sauce if you could just go down the street and buy it? That's because the soy sauce that's in this bottle doesn't taste like soy sauce you buy in a grocery store. It also doesn't taste like really good artisanal soy sauce that you buy in Japan. That's because it tastes like Copenhagen and it tastes like Noma. They're similar, but they're different. I write about this in You and I Eat the Same, which are also outside. And that's really the crux of what I'm getting at here. It isn't a lot of work to ferment. You might have to do it a couple times to really kind of understand what's going on and to kind of get your bearings and know what's right and what's wrong and where those control points really sit. But a lot of it's just a bit of chopping and mixing, and most of it's waiting. Like I said, not that exciting. But the real transformative power comes when you taste the finished product. You go to a sushi restaurant, eat nigiri, just raw fish on rice, it's okay. You eat nigiri with really good soy sauce, it's amazing. That's the difference maker. What grows where you are? Is it fava beans? Is it cranberry beans? Is it orca beans? Because they'll all taste different when they're done. And that's why the fermentation lab has created hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ferments. All of them good, but maybe 5% good enough to serve in the dining room of Restaurant Noma. But the diversity of flavor, the diversity of ingredients, the sheer possibility, that's the thing that drives us in the restaurant. That's why we wrote this book, in the hopes that maybe some of you will catch that kind of magic spark and, you know, tell us about it, and that'll spur us on even more. That's the beauty of all of this. Everything we've done in the restaurant has always been in the pursuit of flavor. We can't stress that enough, that these things will completely change the way you cook, that they'll entice you to keep doing it and get you hooked. Try just a couple recipes, and you'll want to do more.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guests are Rene Redzepi, world-renowned chef and co-owner of Noma in Copenhagen, and David Silber, director of the Noma Fermentation Lab. Their new book is The Noma Guide to Fermentation. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, us telling you all this might just seem like another butt on the bandwagon. Yes, that Whole Foods aisle is already there. It is fair to say that fermentation is trendier than ever, but I don't think at all it's fair to talk about something that's been so essential to human existence for so long as experiencing a trend. And that's because I really truly believe that fermentation today is experiencing an understanding. I get that it might seem scary, but we try and guide you through it in this book. We try and explain the principles, because the principles are far more important than 101 recipes for sauerkraut. The principles will lead you towards discoveries, even your own home kitchens. But even once you get that far, it's not enough to just make these ferments and have them around. We want you to actually put them to good use. Something that Chef and I definitely discussed when we were planning this book is the fact that most fermentation books out there will give you 101 recipes for sauerkraut, but then what do you do with it? How do you cook with it? How do you incorporate this magical, amazing thing into your everyday life? So we guide you through it again, just giving you very off-the-cuff recipes of what we do when we take ferments home from the lab. That's the beauty of it.
And for me, though, I would say, if you're going to put this into use, and if, I mean, you really should. I'd like to say that fermenting people, they're some of the coolest people in the world. I mean, yeah. Being a fermenter, that's something.
It is a big community.
It's a community of people that share. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And it's like really ultra, like if you think those baristas with the no, I don't know sugar in the coffee are annoying, try talking about SCOBY mothers with fermenters. But they share everything. And in this book, we actually put in everything that we got that we think is special, even though that some of them we've been working at for 10 years, some of it 5 years. And if I could hope for one thing is that all of you go and you attack it and you find one thing that you can't live without, that you keep producing. Some of them will be easy and others will be more difficult, but say the chicken wing garum, it's one of the best things that I've had. I mean, it's simply perfect as a condiment on your kitchen shelf. And once you start experimenting on how to build further, you can make a spicy one. As it's brewing, you just put a little bit of habanero in it. And suddenly you have this, you know, imagine Tabasco that just tastes intensely of roasted chicken. You know, intensely, intensely, intensely. And pure and clean. And then with a hit of spice. So that's one that I would recommend you guys to start with, because I know that it's going to be amazing. And one of the things that we were also hoping, actually, which is a bit selfish in this sense, but you know, the idea that people would go and everybody would start fermenting and they would start, you know, not just doing sauerkraut. And then there would pop up all these ideas on the internet. You know, people showing what they were doing, and we would learn. Like, that would be something for us where we could say, oh, man, these what? People in San Francisco, they did this thing.
Why
and apropos
think of
the mason jars, today for breakfast at this coffee bar, we actually saw a cappuccino being served in a mason jar with a handle on. that was the first one for me. I have to say, but it's funny when you land in San Francisco, you know, it's also the first place I've ever seen where it says there's a sign to the baggage and then there's a yoga room as well.
Yeah, okay.
I think this is the perfect place for fermentation. I think you guys are going to help us be better at what we do. So please go ahead and do that. And I think it's time for us to go into a little bit of a Q&A.
Hey, have you done anything with spent beer grain?
What's that?
With spent beer grain?
Spent beer grain, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've kind of like reinfused it into a tea.
Can you explain what it is?
Oh, yes, of course. So, after you brew beer and make your wort.
What's a wort?
Rewinding. Okay, I'll real fast just explain something that comes up in the book. But to get the sugar out of a grain, you have to break down its starch, and that is the process of malting. You take a baby plant, you start sprouting it, and then it starts producing its own digestive enzymes to break down all the starch in that grain. That liberates the sugars, and then you roast it to kill the plant and caramelize those sugars. Once you have that sweet grain, which is malt, you put that into water, and then bring it up slowly to a few successive degrees of temperature, and then all of those sugars leach into your water. Now, that mash can be fermented with yeast, and then you can strain off the liquid and get beer. The leftover mashed up wet grains are then totally useful for other things. We've made we've re-steeped them and made vinegars from them. But anywhere you could extract flavor, you could totally dry them again and then use them as like the cracked wheat in a soy sauce if you want. You'll start seeing the slots in which they can fit, definitely, once you start getting through the book. But there are a lot of places you can do it. You can use it, rather.
Hi. What can you tell us about working with rhubarb? I know that's like a super popular ingredient.
I mean, it's so common. And it's really a treat when you grow up in Scandinavia because it's such a hardy plant. And it's one of the things that come in the very first signs of real spring. And most Danish kids grow up when they start coming out of the ground that your mother or grandmother will cut them, and then they dip them in sugar and you just chew on them, actually. But that's what you do? Okay. vinegar is very good with it. It's very good as a cordial, which is easy to do. Those are the things that we... Kombucha? Is it too sour?
Yeah, you can sweeten it, but then you have it as a base, for sure. Or just do like half and half juice, like rhubarb juice with something else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very traditional and it's typical for jams and stuff like that. I love the raw juice a little bit, particularly when seafood are good. If you juice them and you can sort of bathe your seafood in it, mm-hmm. It's very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, hello. So I want to ask a question about the juice pairing option in Noma. So I was thinking, like, is that like something come from like when you started like doing the fermentation thing, or it's just like something like you just want to do something for people they don't consume alcohol?
It was for people that didn't want to consume alcohol, and it basically started almost 10 years ago when we first put a juice menu on, and a lot of it come also because I don't drink very much alcohol myself, You know, so you go to restaurants and you have this tasting menu and then you also have a wine tasting. And so at first we thought that we'd make a mix where it's a little bit of juices and wines, but then we just made a full juice menu. And they were very simple at first. It would be just a cucumber juice with, you know, a little bit of salt and some mint steeped in or something like that. And that was 10 years ago. We were a tiny, tiny team. But today it's actually a section of its own.
Yeah.
Like, it's a real, real pain in the ass. And we... it is, and it's also something that actually cost us money to do.
Well,
the thing is, if you can easily have a juice, but if you have too much sugar, it's actually much worse than alcohol, in my opinion, as you're eating and you're drinking these sweetened drinks. So if you mix ferments and fresh juices or cooked juices as well together into a drink that fits, that takes a lot of work. A lot of work.
I'll say that making the basis for the juices, which are often kombuchas, so they're like very mildly alcoholic, some of the juices at Noma, maybe like 0.25% or something. That's one of our biggest jobs at the restaurant, is producing, you know, 20, 30 liters a week of XYZ kombucha, for sure. But it serves us well, definitely.
Hi, have you guys ever tried aging your ferments with non-wine grapes or berries or more seasonal ingredients in, say, oak or in clay, because there are different traditions of making wines in different materials.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you guys have ever experimented with that, like ceramic is very traditional in India. In Georgia, they make wine in clay vats.
Mm, yep.
So just curious about your experiences.
Absolutely. We have a couple kiyoki at the restaurant, like Japanese cedar vats, and they definitely impart a flavor. We have a lot of barrels at the restaurant. There's a section on barrel aging in the vinegar chapter, and I say that it doesn't just apply to vinegar. Fish sauce can be aged in barrels. The beef garums can be aged in barrels. Basically, any liquid ferment can take on that flavor, and it really does make a difference. For the most part, we have a bunch of food-safe plastic buckets, and that's just, from a restaurant standpoint, is easy and cost-effective, and it works. And it doesn't impart any one or other flavor. And we can kind of control what we get it to taste like by that means. But yes, we absolutely do have a few crocks around if we're doing small batches of things. But it's great to experiment. And then you just start to see, you know, all the layers of recombinatorial paths that you can choose when you have, okay, well, I'm going to use this grape and age it in that wood, or make this ferment and add this flour and then have it in, you know, steep it with juniper or whatever, and then you just keep going from there, for sure.
All right, it's easy to talk about all the good stuff, and you said that only 5% actually makes it to the menus. So what is your most epic fail that you've ever fermented?
Every time. Blood garum. Blood garum. Pig's blood garum. It also tastes like death. But I will say that... and
was
this
it blood garum, or was it something else we tasted?
Blood. It was definitely pig's blood. Yeah.
But in the movie, it must have been something else, because, you know, we're used to smelling fermented and funky things, and even sometimes when things go wrong, and then there's blood garum.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, it's truly...
Yeah. I got real clever. That was tried before even my time in Noma, and then, you know, it was kind of the unicorn. It's like, oh, can it be done? And I got real clever, and I started up the centrifuge. I'm like, I'll just take out the hemoglobin, and I'll just ferment the plasma, and that still tastes like so, you can't win them all.
Well, that was also, I remember something, we did something with beets that turned, like, to jelly, or, like, this very gelatinous.
Yeah, no, that,
but that's so many years ago.
That's something that went wrong then. Yeah. If that happened.
It's like when we tasted it, and it's like... You can feel that some of it is here, but you still have some on your tongue.
Yeah.
Question to your right.
What are some of the most common failure points for the home fermenter?
The most common places you could trip up? Maybe making sure your equipment's clean, checking up on your ferments, and kind of tending to them. It's quite easy to just get caught up in your work week and like think that it's going and it's okay, but it is work to just like peer in there and be like, oh, I should wipe this down, or oh, it's not packed down enough, I need to just stuff it in there, or make sure that things are mixed enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about learning from your mistakes, and I've definitely made a lot of mistakes in the lab and didn't check up on something, or didn't make something was cooked enough or you know, mixed well enough, and then you realize, oh, okay, that matters more than I thought it did. So really paying attention to the cues will help to guide you. And, you know, we talk about a lot of the failures. It's not just about laying out a recipe, do this, 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 and this, and then you get it right. It's like, do this, but watch out for this. Do this, but know that you need to understand this. Do
was
this.
It a brine, or was it dry salt? Oh, you put water on. Oh.
That might be why.
Then you diluted it too much, of course. That's the problem. It needs 2% salt.
Yeah.
The last question is over here on your left.
So it seemed like when you talked about the history of Noma and how y'all grew, it kind of followed a little bit how, like, human society worked. We went from foraging to fermentation to kind of, like, keep expanding. Do y'all have any ideas for how Noma's going to, like, keep challenging itself?
Ooh. I feel pretty challenged at the moment where we are, but... I think two things that I'd like to really to be a part of our future, which is going to be very challenging, is how to be part of a positive change in our industry. That is something we're working on and have been for a while. It's not easy. It feels like sometimes you're on a rowboat and you have you're trying to turn a super tanker around. And then also, you know, how will our choices impact the planet? if not to be too big about it, but I do think that the restaurants of the future, they will, any single business, they will have to participate in making the world a better place. And the two places that we think is the future is particularly in how we deal with each other as humans and what sort of output we have. And within those two things, there's of course a myriad of solutions and ways and maybe the most interesting, as we are learning this year with our three seasons, could be something to do with a vegetarian future for us. Maybe that's it could be. For instance.
For sure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were Rene Redzepi, world-renowned chef and co-owner of Noma in Copenhagen, and David Zilber, director of the Noma Fermentation Lab. Their new book is The Noma Guide to Fermentation. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.